For joining us in this moment. Today we have special guest Charles Shaw. He is a creator of all kinds, an author, a filmmaker, a radio producer and host, and most importantly, a human rights activist. Without further ado, let's dive in with Charles. Joining us today. I am really excited, Aid, you continue to create in the arena where we need more documentaries and literature on what's going on planet Earth right now, so that really, even if people don't completely understand it, at least we have some history being recorded, which is very helpful. So thank you for being part of that.
My pleasure.
I would love for you just to give a little bit of a synopsis of the movie, The Plastic People, and just to set the setting, not to give it all away, and then we'll dive into our conversation from there.
Sure. Exile Nation, The Plastic People is a film that follows the lives of a number of Mexican-American immigrants who were deported from the country following the kind of unofficial pogrom of migrants, illegals, Muslims, and anything that happened after 9/11. There was a series of laws passed, including the Immigration Reform Act and the Border Security Act and things like that, and House resolutions that ended up sending somewhere between 4 to 6 million people out of the country. And 97% of those are Latino. The majority of them are Mexican. And my film follows a specific group of those people who immigrated to the United States many, many years ago, most of them as children, not by their own will, but with their parents, and grew up as Americans in the United States. But then after this 9/11 policy shift, they started being rounded up and deported for anything from a minor traffic infraction to a felony. And so I was introduced to the story through a gentleman named Chris Bava, who was a former heroin trafficker and heroin addict who was in Tijuana getting Ibogaine treatment. And I had interviewed him for my very first film, this kind of long and unwatchable oral history on the drug war that I made. And he, in the process of that interview, he, talked quite a bit about what he had just, recently discovered in Tijuana. So that led to a lot of discussions about making a film, and eventually we made a film about it.
Years ago, I went to Sundance and I watched a Michael Moore movie called Troubled Water. And so I'm going to ask you a question that I asked him, not in specific to your film, because when you're creating a film like this, it's my hope from the filmmaker, that they start to have some ahas on solution, although you're really shining a light on one level perceivable problem, but then it's a much bigger problem that most people on planet Earth don't really understand.
Right.
So if you could share maybe any ahas that you had as far as how to shift the situation in the immediate future and then potentially in the long-term future.
Well, I mean, there is a simple policy fix to stop this mass deportation. And what we were hoping to do throughout the time we were making this film was to get enough attention towards the issue from the film in order to compel members of Congress to pass a resolution or a law which allowed these people to see an immigration judge before they were deported, to actually plead their case. They are summarily deported, which means that once they get picked up, they're locked up, transported, and dropped off, stripped of everything and dropped off. They don't see a judge. They don't get to plead their case. They get nothing. So all we wanted was to just put one provision in to let them see a judge. And when the immigration reform collapsed, we were really despondent. And then Obama stepped in and said he was going to use executive action. And right now we're waiting to see what the actual end result of that is. Do I believe that the president should use executive action? It's a dicey topic, but I hate to say it, but we've already had so much precedent over since Kennedy, really, or Roosevelt even, if you want to go back that far, of executive privilege and presidents having to take steps that our Congress won't take, that in the case of, for example, the civil rights movement, I happen to think it was a good thing to do. In the case of, for example, the war in Iraq or any of this stuff, I think it was a miserable mistake. But the larger problem, Suzanne, really is people's attitudes towards immigrants and migrants and people of other colors, which is really what it all boils down to, people of different cultures and people of different colors. And that's a much, much deeper entrenched problem in our culture that is almost impossible to break through. And I've seen it. I was raised with it in a conservative Republican family in Chicago. And we were raised with that type of racism that was inherent in Chicago. And, you know, most of us have spent our lives repudiating. And it runs deep. And it is a policy and a practice that our ruling elite, you know, our government and the corporations that fund them, use to divide us. They're the ones that are constantly seeking the cheapest possible labor. They are the ones setting up the conditions for all of these people to come to the United States and work. They came here at our invitation. This is the thing that everybody doesn't understand. They say, get in line. They were invited. We passed NAFTA and we invited millions of these people to come and take these jobs that Americans wouldn't take. And then when it became a politically convenient excuse to blame them for economic conditions, which goes back all the way to when Catholics first started coming to the United States and Chinese first started coming to the United States, Mexicans first started coming. Each time a new ethnic group came in, it was as if the world was coming to an end. They feared that the Catholics would take over the country because they were loyal to the papacy. They were afraid that Jewish people would take over the country because there was this alleged Zionist banking conspiracy. They were afraid that the Chinese were going to take over because the Chinese would work for $1 a day building the railroads. They were afraid the Mexicans would come because, again, same thing over and over. And this just keeps getting reinvented for every generation. And it's intractable, really. So what I try to do with this film and what I've been trying to do in larger discussions about it is to connect this to the overwhelming issue of migrants across the world. So this isn't just a problem that the United States and Mexico are dealing with. This is a problem that is happening with Africans and Arabs attempting to get into the EU. And we have this exact same problem going on at the Spanish border with Morocco and in Sicily and southern Italy with boat people. We also have boat people problems in Australia, people coming from Indonesia and Malaysia and Indochina and those regions. And we have the persistent problem of Palestinian refugees. And so this is something that is a huge issue. In fact, migration is one of the biggest issues in the EU right now. And after, you know, the incidents in Paris last week, once again, you know, they're screaming bloody murder. And, you know, there's lots of different ways that governments try to use situations like these to, you know, bend policy to their will. And I was in England this summer when the whole situation went down with this supposed ISIS group, a group that we created, funded, and sent in to fight the Bashar regime in Syria, and then who turned around and invaded Iraq. This is exactly what we wanted, by the way. This is what we've always wanted. Not we, you and I, but obviously those people.
Please clarify for the listeners.
Yes, those people. The militarists and their friends, you know, so all of this, you know, there's the more beheadings, you know, more vague videos, you know, zero proof of anything. But what the political result was that, and nobody in America knew about this because they weren't talking about it. In England, the big issue was, does the government have the right to rescind passports, take away citizenship to people who have questionable political allegiances? So what that whole thing with ISIS was an ability for the government to take another step and to remove citizenship summarily, simply by an accusation of association. So with almost every problem you see with immigration, there's actually a real political, a very different and very real political agenda behind it.
Absolutely. Well, a couple things stood out to me in your film. One, you know, I don't know who said it at the end, towards the end, but about, you know, it's natural for a human to migrate, and Native American, if you, and many indigenous cultures, they migrate just because maybe the food supply dries up or can earth conditions change. So it's very natural for us to do this, and animal kingdom teaches us this, and so does the insect kingdom. So we're not different in my mind. So knowing, and then the other thing that stood out to me was that, you know, basically these people are just being forced into prostitution, into drug use, abuse, trafficking. And did you have any sense when you were filming down there, could they like walk inland, or was there somewhere where they could just like abandon ship?
No. They were confined to a roughly 4 to 6 square block area in Zona Norte. If they stepped outside of that area, they were arrested, brought to La Vente, which is the jail, where the police would look through open cases that they'd had no suspects for, and then they would pin these unsolved cases on whoever they had in custody. And they would clear cases that way and send these people off to La Mesa Penitentiary, which is as close to hell on earth as you could probably imagine.
So then, the other, when you were speaking earlier, this is just a complete human rights issue.
This transcends immigration and anything like it. This is a strictly human rights issue at this point. Hmm. Yeah.
And it, does anyone on a global level have interest in this case, or are they just choosing to ignore it?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and one that in answering became one of the biggest shocks of this entire thing. I mean, listen, I don't have any illusions that like the work that I'm doing is, you know, going to cause massive sea changes in opinion or anything. And I certainly, you know, don't have any like delusions of grandeur or unrealistic expectations. But what I did expect was that the Mexican people and the Mexican American organizations that were purportedly there to help their own people would stand up and help support these folks. And in fact, they don't want to have anything to do with them. These are not the proper faces of the immigration reform issue that they want shown. You know, they want the college educated, raised in America, relatively affluent, speaks perfect English, doesn't look ethnic Mexican to represent immigration reform. And that really broke my heart. And it's okay, in a sense, because people are quick to jump to conclusions and judge and condemn. It's just our nature. And they look at these folks. Most of them have always lived in poverty. And they live in these very small, insular communities where it's mostly other Mexican migrants. They live in constant terror of La Migra, being deported and having their families ripped apart. And, you know, Americans turn around and say, well, they shouldn't have come here illegally. And, you know, that whole concept of illegal movement, which is very interesting. And, you know, they said, well, you know, they were criminals. Well, yes, but I think if you were to look back at every single ethnic group, when they got here, they all were essentially outside the system. They were not able to call the police. They were not able to go to the courts. They were not able to do anything. They had to form their own gangs, mobs, mafias, parallel governments, and all of that stuff. And then eventually they moved their way up into respectable American society. This is the Irish, this is the Jewish, this is the Italians, this is the Polish, this is even now the Russians, and the Japanese, and the Koreans, and the Chinese. But somehow the Latin Americans are the ones that are always kept down, and the Africans are kept even lower than them. So when you have no people that will claim you, when the country that you've given yourself to rejects you and throws you out, and the country that gave birth to you rejects you and throws you out, you are what's known as a nationless person. And that is a very frightening place for any human being to find themselves, because they have absolutely no rights whatsoever.
Absolutely. And they're gridlocked.
Yes. Yeah, it's intense.
Yeah.
It really makes me very, very grateful for like all of the blessings that I have in my life. It also makes me feel a tremendous sense of guilt. And I don't mean like white liberal guilt. I mean like just the straight up guilt that I felt when I had to leave those guys there.
Yeah.
When I couldn't take them with me. That was the hardest part of making Plastic People. Mm. And it destroyed me for a year afterwards. And I just knew that every day they were living in those sewers and I got to go home to my comfortable bed, you know?
And let's talk about that a little bit. You've been such a prolific poster on that beautiful thing called social media that we all love to hate.
Yeah, let's talk about Facebook.
I what do you mean? I don't. But it creates conversations nonetheless, and there are people in there that are really attached to it, I guess, to say the least. But.
Yeah.
When we realize, like in that moment when you realize you're your fellow human species, because we're all human, we're two-legged, and you're having to leave them in dire straits, you can't even rescue them if you wanted to, which you did, how do we start to shift where people, I don't know, start to realize that there are so many people suffering things that are mind-boggling, yet they feel pretty entitled to participate in things like narcissism, righteousness in the way of complete disregard maybe for everyone except themselves. How would you encourage people with first world problems to really think beyond themselves and start taking just little shifts in their life? Because some of that can start to maybe give communities the courage to stand up for their fellow man and woman.
Yes. Well, I think that the best thing that I try to tell people, and unfortunately it's really hard to get this across to folks, is that particularly in the Western first world, the predominantly Christian white world, everything that we understand to be a social construct, all of our laws, policies, cultural beliefs, morals, and all these things, when you really look behind them, they're all set up to reinforce the system that exists. And so they make virtues out of what would otherwise be decisions with very little integrity or very little lack of consideration or compassion. They turn these into virtues, things like war, things like predatory capitalism, you know, things like property rights, the right of the police. I mean, all of these things which violate, you know, any type of like common sense morality, but also, you know, violate a lot of basic human rights, are all held up because they defend the system. And then what part of that doesn't work, what they use is fear. And they make us terrified that we're going to lose what we have. And it's usually economic fear that is primary. You know, people are afraid of losing their livelihoods. There's nothing more terrifying than facing having to be homeless. I recommend everybody try it one time in their life. I've done it. It's a life-changing experience, and it definitely teaches you more about humanity than you will ever know. Not necessarily the best. But most people will never go through that. Most people live very comfortable lives. So you have to try to show them that the whole system is set up, you know, in order to keep them doing exactly what they're doing and to keep them from actually, like, changing the situation. It becomes much more pernicious when you start to look into communities that you and I are familiar with, where there is a tremendous amount of cultural appropriation, specifically of Native and Indigenous peoples' cultures and rituals. Now, there is a vehement argument out there that has been going on for a couple of years for people who have this idea in their head. There's no such thing as culture. You can't own spirituality. You can't own a feather. Right. It belongs to God. It belongs to Mama Gaia. It belongs to the universe or whatever. And what they don't understand is that this is just a reformatted version of the same imperialism that the British Empire, which we are a part of, spread around the world. So this idea that people could migrate freely was a mark of savage, uncivilized people, hunter-gatherers, people that were a step up from cave people, as the British used to see. It was their mandate to civilize us, right? To civilize all of these people, to bring them Christ, and to bring them into civilization, to put them into one place and to control them. And the same type of attitude goes into the cultural appropriation of things like Native Americans. Yeah. Now, I mean, I have a lot of personal experience with this because my sister of 40 years, who passed away last year, was Native American. She was Ojibwe. So I spent my entire life connecting to that history and that struggle and trying to understand it as best I could. And the truth of it is some of the most appalling history that I have ever come across. I mean, we committed essentially 200-year genocide against the Native American people of this country. Genocide. And it wasn't just outright warfare. We didn't need to do that because what we did was we turned them loose from their land where they were able to hunt and plant and survive. And we sent them to places that were inhospitable. And on the way, most of them died. And when they got there, they couldn't feed themselves. And we did these little things like give them smallpox-ridden blankets and such. And that wiped out most of the rest of them. Yeah. And they don't consider that genocide. They say, oh, well, that was just nature. You know, and they actually say this. You know, you can't consider that genocide. Hmm. They say there was, you know, a couple hundred thousand Native Americans. There was closer, probably 25 to 100 million people in the Americas, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Arizona is only 100 years old, so that kind of shows you what was going on there, that wasn't able to be brought into the nation.
Yeah.
As little as 100 years ago, and then how many tribes were actually existed in Arizona, and that they built huge institutes in Riverside to try to deprogram certain tribes in Arizona. They kidnapped the children.
Yes, yeah, the schools, the boarding schools. They did that in Canada as well, and that came from England. And that was part of the same imperial conditioning model where it's essentially a trauma-based system of control. You take children away from their families, you break the bond between the parents and the child and the community, you cut their hair, which is, as brazen a symbol of taking their power as you can get. Yep. You put them in Christian clothes, you teach them Christian dogma, you beat them, and eventually they conform.
Yeah, or they walk away.
Or they destroy themselves.
Yeah. Wow, this is getting really heavy, Charles.
Yeah, you know, try living in my head for like a week. It's a really fascinating place to be.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm right there with you, really. More than you know. So when we look at this long historic problem, and then you look at something like that's going on in France right now, so we'll talk about critical thinking, because I was even reflecting on this morning, I'm like, wow, I go, they created this internet, and so they don't even have to create half the the veils because everyone's talking and they don't even know what they're saying and creating gibberish.
Yes, it's known as the cybernetic theory of social control. It's actually an established doctrine. It was developed in the post-war era. It really started to take off in the 1980s after the government released sections of what was the original internet, the ARPANET, which was invented as a communication system in the event of a nuclear war so that military bases would be able to continue to command and control each other. And then it was eventually released to the public. And so first there was, you know, the AltNet system and then very private computers. But there was a whole like system of cybernetic theory that came out of, you know, Ivy League institutions and big think tanks that was all about a self-regulating system. And this is actually where the New Age culture came from as well, is it was a thoroughly engineered construct that came out of the post-war era by social engineers, anthropologists, you know, billion-dollar foundations, intelligence agencies, and the like, that were trying to really understand how to control people and how to kind of breed out the authoritarian matrix, they called it, which led to such things as fascism and the Holocaust. You know, there was actually a very good intention behind it in the beginning. The Macy conferences, Margaret Mead, you know, famous anthropologist, and this, you know, high-level policy group got together and started forging ahead with a new idea for a new culture, which they called a post-national, multi-ethnic society with no fixed borders. And that's essentially what the basic fundamental precepts of the New Age are. It takes all religions, all cultures, melts them together and says we are all one. And it's a trick. It's a trick of the mind. And so in promoting this idea and also creating a system of self-regulation called cybernetics, which is using technology and psychology, in order, you know, otherwise known as Facebook, to control people's behavior and to faction them off into like-minded enclaves of like-minded thinkers. And the more that you isolate yourself into like-minded enclaves of like-minded thinkers, the less critical thinking, the less critical perspective you employ with anything, because everything reinforces your confirmation bias.
Yeah, more freaky yeah. It is.
Yeah, so the thing was, you know, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, a man who unfortunately was a test subject in the MKUltra program, which is probably why he ended up the way he was. But also he had a conscience, and his manifesto, if you ever read it, is pretty harrowing. And it pretty much describes the world that we live in today. He was warning us about this 20 years ago. Now, this is not to say that I in any way sanction any of the activities that he purportedly or allegedly did, like blowing people up. I mean, I don't understand that, and I will never sanction anything like that. But the ideas that the man put out and the things that came out of his experience with MKUltra and cybernetics research at Harvard led him to a very dark place where he saw where humanity was going. He did have the foresight to see that. I think what was left of not crazy in him drove him completely crazy. And that's a really fascinating story that you can look into. Also, you know, all of the collusion of all of these like famous, you know, ex-hippies like Stuart Brand and Steve Jobs and Paul Allen that formed the cybernetic system and formed the internet and the whole information technology wave. It's pretty scary. I'm not entirely sure that it was like an intentional construct. I think that as with almost anything, like it starts off with good intentions and then gets co-opted by darker forces. And this whole thing that happened with creating the New Age culture and trying to avoid the authoritarian matrix only lasted until essentially the fascist coup when they killed Kennedy and kind of took over and pointed us in the other direction. And so that's when they flipped it on its head and said, well, you know, we can use this to control people. And they did it at the exact moment that America was starting to go through a profound cultural shift. And so they just took advantage of it and rode it into the sunset.
Absolutely. How would you recommend to, you know, someone close to you to start to unplug from those control mechanisms? And I guess you can share how you've done that. You've walked into many of them.
Yes, I sure have. I can
How
admit
have you unplugged, Charles?
I can admit to making every mistake, swallowing every line, buying every piece of bullshit that was out there, because I had a need to believe, because I knew that what I saw and what I was being taught and everything was wrong. I mean, that was obvious. But the thing was, there wasn't any like credible or tangible answers in its place. So in the place of like a credible answer, you start filling in the details with all kinds of things. And those details and those stories are shaped by the kind of cultural bias. So you have, you know, people out there screaming to bloody murder about the, you know, the blood sucking, baby killing Satanists out there. And when you look behind that, you start to see that these are all largely evangelical Christians, and they see everything as a battle between God and Satan, right? And so everything that is occult to them, for example, is seen as satanic. I guess what I'm saying is we have this tool, this like internet thing. It's right here. Like I'm staring at this keyboard right now. I'm staring at the screen. In that thing are the answers to every question you've ever wanted in your entire life. You just have to know how to look for them. And people just don't either want to look for them, or they claim they don't have the time, or they have other priorities. I mean, you can't really argue with people when they make their own priorities, but when we start talking about our collective well-being, I feel like we kind of owe ourselves a higher standard. And so one of the ways that I tried to do this for a while, but I realized it was absolutely futile, was to try to go around when I would see people posting, you know, information that had no credible sources or no sources at all, that they're pulling off of these, you know, ridiculous conspiracy sites that were clearly like, you know, pieces of disinformation and racist or anti-Semitic or whatever it was. I would try to like say, okay, you know, this isn't really credible. It doesn't have any source material. It doesn't name anything. It doesn't do this, doesn't do that, blah, blah, blah. Here's where it doesn't matter. You know, you would get 10 times the vitriol back just trying to explain, hey, you know, maybe you should think twice about posting something like this. I mean, you know, I can't personally judge too much because I've, you know, done a fair share of it in the past myself before I kind of got wise to some of this. I didn't really understand what disinformation was for so many years. You know, when I finally understood it, and then I understood how much of it is there and how much of it is pumped at us as a regular course of events, as a regular matter of policy, that's when I started to really get overwhelmed. Because what it does is like, you know, I've said this in one of the presentations I give. There's a video people can see. It actually explains a lot better than I'm doing right now. It's called Are We All One? The Engineering and Management of Social Movements and Alternative Cultures. And what I essentially try to describe is that, you know, there's this very popular meme of waking up, but like, you know, we are essentially waking up into another dream. And it's already been like, it's a golden cage that's been carefully crafted. And so what, you know, people, they realize that so many people are just kind of rejecting the initial programming. I mean, most people still have it. Like the vast, vast, vast majority of people in the Western world are still firmly ensconced in this matrix, as we call it. They firmly believe reality is this when it really isn't. They can't even see the fundamental dissonances within the system, right? But then there's the people that claim that they're awake. And these are the people that are the most dangerous, because most of them are simply in just another level of sleep. And it's one that is almost entirely populated with some of the most ridiculous ideas and disinformation. But these ones are so fantastical that they appeal to the mind that thinks that it is unique because it rejects the basic programming. But what it leads to is just a kind of parallel extremism that is just as bad, where you have prevailing ideas such as Western medicine has no value and doctors know nothing. That is an extremely dangerous thought.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm not saying that Western medicine's got it figured out any more than Eastern medicine. In fact, we've all kind of seen it's kind of a balance of the two that really helps us. With anything, it's a balance that helps us, certain measures of each. But what we find is extremism. It's no longer, you know, an elite group of the wealthy that have for hundreds of years, certainly since the beginning of the mercantile and colonial adventures, ruled the system. No, they have to become shape-shifting reptilians and baby-sacrificing Satanists. And it's embarrassingly laughable. And it pains me to see people put out there, as it pains me to see all of this, like, terribly anti-Semitic propaganda going around. And, Suzanne, here's what it really is. The bottom line is, Americans in particular, and, you know, Westerners in general, the average person is not very well educated these days and is certainly not very literate. The average American holds about a 6th to 8th grade literacy level. And this is college educated Americans, people that have gone and studied marketing and advertising and all of these things, but they don't study the classics. And they certainly do not study language, linguistics, history, and some of the, you know, more important subjects of classical education. So by the time, you know, if you look at how you have to break an idea down, like, say, the formation of the United States or the Declaration of Independence or the Civil War to a 6th grade to 8th grade class, you have to make it very simple for them to understand it. You can't get into the complex machinations of British investment in Southern cotton, which was going to Northern factories, and the triad of transportation that was going on, and the debate between the nationalists and the state federalists over which form of government should or should not exist, and whether or not the government had the right to mass conscript soldiers, and whether or not industrialism was going to overtake agrarianism. These are, like, way too complicated for people. So what do we have? Slavery. And so we say slavery. And so then these guys, you know, they go to high school, which isn't much better. They go to, you know, state college or whatever. They get their marketing degree or their, you know, their art degree or whatever, but they don't study anything outside their, like, specific discipline. And so even as adults, they're still working with, like, an 8th grade level of historical understanding. And the kind of detail that actual history involves, the kind of complex, conflicting areas of interest, really only exists at the upper university level. When you start to, like, really look at what happened in history. Right. And then when you look at it in this extremely detailed microcosmic scale, you start to see that all of history is essentially, as Orwell said, the same static battle between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
And this, you know, this ever-shifting high, middle, and low, and constant revolutions. You know, I used to call myself a revolutionary until I understood what revolution actually means. A revolution means simply the replacing of one regime with another. That's it. It doesn't mean any substantive change to the system itself. It just means there's been a revolving of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Drop the R.
Drop the R, yes. Yes. Well, what's scary, though, is these people that think they're awake are actually thinking they're evolving and that they're actually regressing. That's the scariest thing, too. Because when you shrink your social network to people that only think, talk, and look like you, and then you shun everybody outside of it as, patriarchal or what, I mean, whatever the term they want to use, whatever they use to try to, like, elevate themselves. What is that actually doing? Is that evolution or is that regression? To me, it looks like regression.
Absolutely. I love, as you're talking right now, I have a hawk flying down to attack this neurotic squirrel that I have that lives near me.
I have a theory that the squirrels are all interconnected and that there is a worldwide conspiracy, just so you know, but I won't get into that right now.
Might be appropriate.
I have a picture of one of them, one of their leaders, on my Facebook page, though.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, yesterday the hawk is going to win, I think. So, stuck in a wheel, a gerbil wheel.
Indeed, we are.
And how would you recommend, or how have you, like you said, you know, the beautiful part is to, you know, believe something as truth and then realize it's not and be bold enough to realize, and, you know, that you can say this isn't true anymore and move on to the next untruth, maybe. So if you can share, maybe to give people some courage to look outside the box and I don't know, play a little bit more Red Rover with one another?
Well, you know, I mean, I think knowledge is power, you know, it always has been. And it's also, you know, self-empowerment. Like the more you know, the more you grow. And, you know, they used to say that on was like the Saturday morning cartoons and stuff like that. But it's true. It's totally true. Because you grow with knowledge. And when you understand the depth of complexity and everyone's struggle, you start to like lose things like partisanship. You know, you start to stop thinking that like the Israelis are evil and the Palestinians are noble. And you start to see two people that are deeply traumatized and have deep-seated hatred and animosity towards each other. And that only that larger meta situation of conflict resolution can really help, of understanding both sides and giving each their validity. Well, I mean, that's next to impossible in this world. You know, it's actually more difficult for me to get people to go and research something that they believe in to confirm whether it's true than it is to get them to buy me dinner for a month and pay my rent. There's a fear. Yeah. There's a genuine fear. And I think it's so rooted in the ego, in the sense of like, oh, my God, I don't want to have to admit that I was completely wrong about this. But see, that's the only way I've found that any of us like grow or learn anything is by making mistakes. Absolutely. And being able to stand up and say, God, I really screwed that up. And I really learned my lesson on this one. Those are the people I trust. The people that pretend like they don't ever make a mistake and who sit in judgment of others, these people have things in their closet I don't want to meet.
Yeah. How can you share, being that most people may not be a continual student, as some of us get more excited about doing that, could you encourage them or show, give them simple tips on how to do a little research on the internet and how to distill out things that are not very reputable?
Yes. Well, I mean, anything that offers you a very simplistic explanation like aliens or the Jews or something like that, that's your first tip. And also anything that does not have hard evidentiary trail. So I say this, like people is like, we have abundant evidence of alien life. No, we have zero evidence of alien life. We only have evidence of things flying around in the sky. That vague photos and videos of things flying around in the sky. And all of that can be explained by classified weapons, propulsion, and technology systems. And all of the kind of crazy stuff on top of it can easily be explained by the millions and millions of dollars that went into pumping out disinformation to confuse, misdirect, and otherwise mislead the public about all of this top secret stuff going on. Because it wasn't just technology and it wasn't just UFOs. It was an entire covert secret system. I mean, an entire parallel system to our own that sucks hundreds of billions of dollars from our system every year. And we never see where it's spent. We have ideas. We've been able to piece together things. But they've built a parallel society, a parallel civilization based on completely covert means. And they do whatever they want with impunity. And, you know, looking at that, you have to start looking at what is there evidence of? Like, where can you find court documents? Where can you file an FOIA request, which is Freedom of Information Act? It's becoming more and more difficult to do that these days, but it's still available. It takes time, but it's available. But also, everything that's been written is out there. So if you're looking and reading a book and it has source citations, go and look at the source citations. Like, actually check and see, A, did the author quote accurately what the source material says, or did the author twist the material around? Because that happens quite a bit. Okay. Interpretation is a huge part of the game. So there are, you know, conclusions that people draw based on pieces of information that aren't necessarily correct. I mean, we all do this. But what we try to do in the field of journalism and research is to put out as much possible evidence, actual evidence as possible, and then draw conclusions based on that, like a police detective would when investigating a crime. It's the same steps. So you talk to people, you talk to witnesses if you can, you look at witness testimony, you look at the available pieces of video, documentary evidence. You look at what government documents, you look at what news reports have been written about them, and you start to look deeper into the backgrounds. And when you, you know, you start parsing out the sources, you can see the ones that, like, you know, have respectable credibility and the ones that necessarily aren't or that have an ulterior agenda. But if you can't find, you know, there's no evidence of reptilians, Atlantis, Anunnaki. Well, the Anunnaki thing is just a terribly, like, mistranslated scam that was put over this guy's Zachariah Sitchin. And he got away with it because he was doing it in an era when people could not check the information. So what people don't know about this guy is that, you know, he was one of a few people at the time that got access to a set of cuneiform tablets that were found in the Sumerian area, right? And going all the way back to Sumer, you know, the first empire. But what these were Babylonian tablets. They're essentially like office records that had been written in the next dynasty in the Babylonian Empire, right, about the Sumerian Empire. So you're still going back 1,000 years. So there's all of that translation and all of that colloquialism that's lost going from the first empire to the second. But then what Sitchin did was is he took the 12 basic ancient languages of the region, like Akkadian and Sumerian and Babylonian and the Aramaic, and he laid them all out. And each one of the characters had a different interpretation based upon which dynasty and which base language was being used. And so he selectively interpreted what he could. So you pull an Akkadian definition here and a Aramaic definition here. That's not the way you do it. Okay. And then to make it all worse, he had one little piece of the tablet, which was about maybe 3 inches by 2 inches, that was on a pin that was in sealed inside a piece of plastic that he would hold up at the front of the room. And he would never let anybody touch it or see it. So, and then he wrote this entire 12-book series on this secret history of our origins. And he did it at the most opportune time during the 1970s, when there was a massive meta shift going on, where a gigantic chunk of the Western world was letting go of the old religious order. They were abandoning Christianity primarily and Judaism in a minor way. A smaller measure, and they were in the midst of an existential crisis because, as Jung taught us, and as we, you know, understand, at least those of us that are in any way connected to some kind of spiritual practice, that we are inherently spiritual beings, that we have to have that part of ourselves nurtured just like the rest of us. So without gods and angels and stuff, without that archetype in us, we needed another archetype. So we just did a one-to-one transfer from the biblical God, Yahweh, the old guy in the beard, to these, you know, beings that came and engineered us. It's the exact same story, just flipped over. And so then, you know, by extension, years later, like gray aliens became angels, you know, angels became gray aliens. And there was this kind of transfer that went on in the minds of people. Now, you cut to a few years ago, and enough anthropologists had had it with Sitchin going around pushing all of this information, and people like Graham Hancock and Robert Schock, who have their theories that the pyramids were built by aliens and that the Sphinx was built by aliens and that it's 10,000 years old. And a consortium, and that means a very large group of accredited anthropologists and archaeologists from around the world, started debunking the work. And so the books would come out. Like, Graham Hancock sold something like 12 million copies of his books. I mean, the man did very well for himself as a dilettante, as a journalist, not an archaeologist, not somebody who knows anything about the science of archaeology. And he just kind of repeated other theories, basically Robert Schock's primarily. But these have been roundly dismissed by groups. And they finally said enough is enough. And so the University of Chicago took that Babylonian dictionary, that source material that Zachariah Sitchin claims to have found and translated, and actually translated it using an official consortium, and they put it up online on their website. So you can go and cross-reference everything. Mm. And when you start putting in words and phrases that Sitchin said, you find that they don't pop up anywhere in this thing. And what you find is that the story was almost completely fabricated based upon just taking the old stories from the Old Testament and repurposing them for a new generation. And then it gets even worse when you find that he doctored his photos so that the famous photo of the panel with the Anunnaki gods looking at the model of the solar system with all the planets in the right order, that was a doctored photo. The actual tablet looks nothing like that. So, you know, these are the things that, like, it's right there. Like, it took me an afternoon to debunk something that I believed for 10 years. You know, and this was, like, to me, I mean, as far as I was concerned, this was incontrovertible. Not only was there, like, large numbers of people backing this up, but the explanations were perfectly plausible, and I simply cannot believe that all of these people would get together under some kind of conspiracy to keep Zachariah Sitchin silent, you know? It just, these are the types of unfeasible conspiracies, because it's one thing to have institutional control, but when the average layperson who is also an archaeologist gets together and says, no, this isn't right, you know, and they're operating on their own, that's another level of confirmation that most people don't even think about as well.
Absolutely.
So it's just this, like, it's this need for simplicity and a simple explanation and a simple everything that really is at the root of so much of it.
Yeah, I mean, many incidences that have occurred, like you said, even from 9/11 on, it takes just some simple observations to start to decode the situation.
Yeah, I mean, everything's right in front of your eyes. It's just that we have been tricked, trained, brainwashed, and otherwise modified to not believe our own eyes.
Right.
And now with the way that we can manipulate media, I'm not so sure you can believe your eyes.
Absolutely. Although, you know, I'm kind of excited for our incoming generations, because I have two children and they are really masterful. They know immediately what's not true and what's true. So something must be happening.
Well, you know, here's the most frightening thing of all. There's a movie that's coming out next year. I saw a trailer for it last night. It's called Iron Sky. It is basically the story of what really happened to the Nazis. And basically, it has Sarah Palin as the president of the United States, and it turns out she's a reptilian, and she goes to Middle Earth and meets Hitler, who's riding a dinosaur. And it's like, you know, the real story is finally revealed. And not only this, but these people raised, are you ready for this? $600,000 to make this movie.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, in the three movies that I have made, I have not I've raised like barely a tenth of that.
Wow.
That's what the people want, you see? And how do you get at the root of that? Like, how do you shake people away from this illusion?
Right. Well, as long as the need for vanity is there, you know what I mean? There's this play that's going off on the self, the ego.
The culture of narcissism.
Yeah.
Everybody should read the book, by the way. It came out in the 70s. It's called The Culture of Narcissism. It's a fascinating book. And when you read it, you, like I did, may want to run away from Facebook for a long time and seriously reevaluate your relationship to almost everything, including the I and me first statements that characterize American culture. No. Oh, yeah. And by the way, people are circulating this thing now that says the APA is officially designated selfie as a mental disorder. It's not true. They didn't. Yes, it is considered a symptom by the APA of narcissistic personality disorder, but it is not in and of itself an illness, although I'm pretty sure it will be eventually one of these days.
Yeah, I think if you take it to a point where you can't get the perfect picture before you post it, you probably have a problem.
I'm more concerned about the people who are, you know, posting the same, like, glamour shot of themselves taken 30 years ago. And they just keep posting the same series, like, over and over again. And they're, like, 30 years older, and they have no hair, and they've lost their teeth and everything. What that belies is a fear of just being ourselves and accepting our mortality and our weakness, you know? I mean, my God, I've got gray hair, and I like it. You know, I'm not going to change it. I'm never going to get Botox or plastic surgery.
Thank goodness.
You know what I mean? Like, I love me the way I am, like, flaws and all.
Yeah, it's
I got unbalanced eyes. I got a chipped tooth. You know, I got all kinds of problems. But what are you gonna do? It's just me.
Yeah, just be you.
Love it or leave it, Suzanne.
I'll love it. I'll love it. We will not encourage people to alter their physical being for vanity. So what I'd like to close out on is psychedelics, and I know it's not a short conversation, but when, you know, we discuss this whole world system, we're basically generating most of our awareness through psychopathic and sociopathic conditioning.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
And so having participated a healing process with psychedelics and the value of that, but also knowing that that part of that culture is creating disinformation too, how do you feel some of these opportunities to connect to a psychedelic experience could help the consciousness break free from these other conditions? Because it seems to me, the more I look at it, I'm like, I think this all has to happen in the ethers. Not that you don't take right action during your day-to-day living, but there's something to be said that some of this is going to have to happen through our state of mind, our state of being.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as Paracelsus once famously said, the poison is in the dose. And I really believe that to be true about almost everything. My experience with psychedelics is that on a limited scale, they are some of the most powerful and effective healing medicines out there. And they definitely helped me. I don't want to say heal, quote unquote, because that is a finite term. I believe that we never, quote, fully heal. I mean, if you cut your arm open, you're always going to have a scar. Our psyches and our souls are the same way. But we do grow, change, evolve, make peace with it, have wisdom, have compassion, and these are the results of pain. And this is a beautiful thing. If you're willing to face the pain and go through it, you can find the beauty of compassion, the beauty of understanding on the other side. It's a journey I've had to take in a very, very like intensive way in the last 3 years. And I also found the flip side of that is that there is way too much escapism in psychedelics. And if you take too many of them, they feed the ego in a very negative way, and so much of the narcissism that permeates our culture is because of psychedelic indulgence. And, you know, ayahuasca and LSD will tell you things that aren't necessarily true if you keep taking it over and over and over again. And people keep getting deeper and deeper, and they just need to continue to escape. And they don't see that it's escaping, because medicine is to be taken. It is to treat the illness, and then you don't take the medicine once the illness is gone. I mean, it's the same general principle, but so many people, they get a taste and they go crazy and they don't stop. And then they screw up their brain chemistry and they become less and less capable of dealing with actual life and other people. And I mean, I run into these kids at festivals all the time where, like, if you sneeze at them, they will freak out and have a mental breakdown because it's too aggressive. I mean, they just like take too many drugs. And it's scary, because how are you going to survive in life? The world is a brutal place. You cannot trim weed in the hills forever. Like, you're going to have to go out and like make a way, you know, have a family, like contribute to society.
Absolutely. And
unfortunately, what they're not doing is facing those fears. Instead, they're retreating further and further into insular communities. And I just think that that's hurting it. And, you know, as much as I've been deeply connected to the work that groups like MAPS and the Beckley Foundation have done, and I have the utmost respect for what they have accomplished. And Rick Doblin is a personal friend and a man that I happen to respect tremendously. That being said, the culture that surrounds the psychedelic community is its greatest detriment.
Right.
People running around pretending like it's still the 60s are embarrassing all of us. And I'm sorry, I don't know how else to say it, but grow up. Like,
yeah,
oh, please.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean,
the world needs you. Your mother needs you. Our parents are getting old, and are they going to end up in nursing homes like their parents did, or are we going to care for them in the right way? That's real, you know? That's real. So are we going to care for these children that we're siring, or are we just going to abandon them to their mothers, you know? Like, come on, men, step up. Like, there's a lot of this stuff that, like, there's a lot of talk going around about love and heart space and blah, 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 as babies are being abandoned and relationships are shattered and parents are being abandoned and so on and so forth. I just think it's all a bunch of hypocrisy. I would love to see people actually walk their talk.
Uh-oh. I would too.
And on that note, I want to close. I'd like to just talk for a brief minute about my new film and about my new project, because I think it's really speaks to all of this. And I'm about a week away from dropping out fundraising campaign for post-production. We've already spent 18 months filming this. It was originally known as The Phoenix Project. It is now called So Here We Are, a film about trauma. Mm. And it is my experience over the last 3 years going through a series of tragedies that were unexpected, including the death of my collaborators on Plastic People, the overdose death of my sister and two of my very close friends, my dog Nola being run over right in front of me, the end of a relationship that was very important to me, and all these things which brought me into deeper depths of trauma than I had ever experienced, but also gave me the opportunity to really understand it. So I spent like 18 months traveling the world, talking to people about their traumatic experiences and the work they had done to keep themselves together. Most of the subjects that I feature in the film are people that have passed 40, because 40 is a key point in our development where people with severe developmental trauma rarely get past. Hmm. They die young, usually of accidents, illness, or overdoses, or suicide. Hmm. And if not, then 40 is the kind of age where they pass the tipping point and they almost go past the point of no return. Hmm. And so it's imperative to try to communicate to young people that getting on and dealing with your traumas at a young age is a very, very important thing to do. Don't wait until you're in your 40s like I was to do it, because it might be too late. It was too late for my sister, and that will haunt me for the rest of my life. Hmm. But this is my homage to her and to my family, because my sister was a very sweet and sensitive woman. She was not anything like me. She was not an aggressive personality or type A personality. She was a sweet Ojibwe woman that just had a heart that was the size of this world, and this world and what had been done to her people was just too much for her. So this is the best I can do to try to give back to her and to my friends who died, and in the memory of our animal companions, who for many of us trauma survivors, they are what brings us back to love and presence, because they have such a simple, unconditional love. We explore some pretty fascinating stories in this film. I've never really seen anything done like this before. I'm either going to, humiliate myself tremendously or make something very poignant, but either way, I don't really care. It's what I feel needs to be done.
Absolutely. So
I really hope that people out there will support this, because I can't really see anything that's much more needed, particularly when you start looking at the scope of trauma. When you know that every human being will experience a traumatic event in their lives, and that how we deal with it determines what the quality of our life is moving forward, it becomes the ultimate imperative.
Yeah, for many lifetimes to come. When is this project going to be complete, and when does the post-production campaign start?
The post-production campaign should start within a week. I'm just finishing up a pitch video and some language. We've actually been reinventing the project for the last 4 months after we decided that the original idea, this Phoenix Project idea, was actually somewhat disingenuous, because of the very question that we were originally asserting, that we were going to show people who have healed and gotten past things, but in really exploring it, nobody ever really gets past it per se.
No,
we carry it with us forever. It just, our relationship to it changes over time.
Yeah.
And if you let it, it can soften you. And it can build, an amazing, compassionate worldview. But that's only if you let it. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of being courageously facing grief and allowing yourself to cry a lot.
Yeah.
Like a lot, like more than you really might be comfortable or familiar with. And when you get through that part, what is on the other side is freedom, because all of this black tar that has held you down is released. And you can see clearly, and you can hear clearly. And when someone comes and brings you something, you can see that that's their shit. And you don't get it mixed up, and you don't get caught in all these projections.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, we laugh, you know, kind of nervously, but it is an epidemic, particularly in American culture, of projection is a very dangerous and very painful thing for people.
Absolutely.
And it's going on every day, and people don't even, they aren't even aware of it, you know. Yeah. So if this can help people become just a little bit aware of it and understand that trauma is a tool by which the elite control us. We, you know, go, the British Empire was known for trauma-based conditioning in their schools. And that, you know, extends into the military and the way that we use violence, fear of crime, fear of war, fear of the other, fear of this, fear of the environment, fear of economic collapse, blah, 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 and recessions and wars and police actions. They're all trauma-based conditioning to keep us in line. And breaking free of that and coming to a place of compassion is, to me, if there is a revolution, it's that.
I'm proud of you, Charles.
Oh, thanks.
I only
learned this because I listened to people like you and my elders and the people that are patient with me and stuff like that. You know, that's the way I learn. Like, I have to admit to making all of the mistakes, but that is only because I was trying to learn what was right, and I'm at least happy that I tried, you know?
Of course, and it's important to make mistakes because you don't get it till you get it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm really excited for this film and to celebrate that, and what a beautiful piece of work that I think everyone on this planet can relate to in one shape or form or another. So that is exciting.
Let us hope so.
Yes. Well, it will be.
I got like $5 to my name, and I put everything into this thing, and I really am trying to create beauty out of sadness and tragedy.
I know there's many people that need to be in the sadness and the tragedy, you know, and then they find that beauty. So I think you'll have many people connect to it from very, very different reasons.
Yay!
So we will put links on them, and we'll keep promoting it. So I'm excited. So
awesome.
Charles, I am just thankful for you being here on planet Earth at this
Likewise.
Moment.
Likewise.
And for you speaking your truth and continuing to evolve, not revolve.
Mm-hmm. I still spin from time to time.
We all do. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, anytime. Thank you for having me, Suzanne.
Once again, I want to thank Charles for joining us today. Please, if inspired, connect to his written work, his films, and his up-and-coming project, At Home in the Dark. You can assist in getting a message out that there is hope outside of the darkness of trauma. The links are below. The campaign is live. And we're going to exit out with a soundtrack from that movie, At Home in the Dark. Until next time, this is She, with a soft gaze, a full heart, a deep bow, and a namaste. Be simply.
Force fed through. breaks in. An error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. Look for strength and assistance.
Flying the farthest.
A wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it.